Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Well, good evening, everyone. I would like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennis, and I am from Bellevue, Washington. On my host team this evening is Kim Lakin from Colorado. We are both adult survivors of child abuse and members of NASCA. Tonight is special guest night. That's the type of show we're having this evening, and we have a very, very special guest tonight, our NASCA sister, Victoria Kelly from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I will tell you a little bit more about Victoria in a moment, but I wanted to talk to you a bit more now about NASCA and NASCA's mission, because as you know, NASCA is all about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, recovery. We are very dedicated to our mission statement, which is as follows. We have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, abbreviated CSA, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second goal is offering hope and healing through numerous paths, such as our shows, which air five nights a week, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. If you would like to be a member of our panel on the show this evening, we invite you and encourage you to call in. No experience is necessary. The number to call in is area code 646. 595-2118. Again, that number is area code 646-595-2118. And my co-host, Kim Lakin, will greet you on the back line and welcome you into the show. You'll have an opportunity to ask our special guest, Victoria, a question or offer a comment related to what she's going to share with us this evening. So, again, that number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. I know many of us know Victoria, but I'm going to read a little bit about her bio. She provided us her bio to include with the description under the show. This is scan number 3016, so if you go on the NASCA website and look under the show schedule under tonight's date of September 26, 2022, you will see 30 minutes after this show has ended, it will be recorded and archived, and the hyperlink in the description will be this bio that I'm going to read to you about Victoria Kelly. So tonight's special guest is, as I mentioned, Victoria Kelly. She's from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's a returning guest. Not only is she a returning guest, she's a NASCA family member and a one of our Anaska talk show hosts. She will be on Thursday evenings on our Stop Child Abuse Now abbreviated scan shows. But what you may not be aware of is she's also putting together a special event in October for domestic violence awareness in her home state. As you may or may not be aware, Victoria is a child abuse survivor, and she is, as I mentioned, a longtime NASA family member volunteer. And unfortunately, like most of us, Victoria was abused, and Victoria's abuse was almost nearly from birth, and in nearly every way imaginable, unfortunately, even as a baby, an experience that was repeated by numerous predators and perpetrators and went on and on. In addition, her alcoholic father beat both Victoria and her mother, but Victoria thought, as many of us do, that that was simply what happened to a child and a woman when they happen to be living on the wrong side of the track or within the wrong family. She became, Victoria, reclusive and withdrawn, and there was a little justice meted out to any of Victoria's predators. I'm sorry, and there was little justice. There was no justice meted out to any of her predators. Early on, she began to dissociate, a condition that was later in life diagnosed as MPD, multiple personality disorder, sometimes now termed dissociative identity disorder. Victoria eventually spent years going in and out of mental hospitals where she actually was grateful. As she states, at least the staff was kind and helpful. To quote Victoria, I went to a wonderful psychiatrist, and she helped me for 13 years with her multiple personality disorder, the DID, the dissociative identity disorder. She began drinking at an early age, but Victoria sobered up with help from a 12-step group. Her sexual promiscuity led her to numerous bad adult relationships, and it took a long time for her to find the right therapist and path to recovery. But now she is integrated, and years ago, things finally started to come together. Life is still not perfect, but now she's active in helping the struggling, as we know. Among other things, Victoria works to end domestic violence and sexual violence, attends support groups, speaks out at rallies and conferences, supports police, volunteers at shelters, and works directly with women and children to get their basic needs filled, such as food, shelter, and clothing. So, wow, Victoria, and as I have had the privilege of either being your host or on the panel for two of the previous three times that you've been on, and I believe it's been three times you've already been on telling your story on the NASCA show. I know how amazing you are, but I'm, you know, excited to have you on tonight. So for those of you who are listening or will be streaming this later and listening later, you will be able to get a glimpse into Victoria's past as well as the work that she's doing today. So I'm really excited for you to keep doing the work and spreading the word and just being your amazing self. So it's a privilege to be on your host team tonight. I'm going to actually unmute your mic. There you are, unmuted. And Victoria, I just want to welcome you on. Thank you for being on.
Oh, thank you. It's always an honor. NASCA really saved my life because I was in so much shame about being abused, you know, not just the abuse. The abuse lasted until I was 21 before I finally escaped. And we use the term escaped instead of left because it is escaped. And I had a six-month-old daughter when I got away from my biological father, who I refer to as my sperm donor because it's the only good thing he ever did for me. And, you know, it went on, and I don't know, I finally got a bill somehow. I found the NASCA website, got a hold of Bill over 10 years ago, maybe over 12, I don't know. And anyway, I was telling him, you know, and I was telling him, you know, about, you know, my shame and blame and all that kind of stuff that we do. And he explained grooming to me, And I had no idea what all that meant, you know. But it all of a sudden made sense, you know, that, you know, the way that things were set up. And, you know, he threatened me and, you know, blackmailed me and threatened to hurt my daughter, you know, that he was going to get my daughter if I ever left them, because I was a poor woman on welfare. He was woman on the community and church and, you know, business, and this man and family loved them and everything else, you know. And I was like, you know, the problem. And he said, you know, nobody will believe you, first of all, as he was doing S&M and all that stuff, you know, sadomasochism and torture. And, you know, he said, if you tell anybody your story, they don't believe it anyway. They're just going to lock you up and take, you know, take her away from her, you, and I'll have her to myself, you know. And like you had mentioned that I was, you know, I was molested before. Well, I guess when I got home from the hospital, because I remember him saying, the day you got home from the hospital after you were born, you wanted to suck on my penis. So, I mean, yeah. So let's just say, yeah. The day I got home from, you know, being born. So, yeah.
Said a very, very, very sick
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
Evil.
And he died about 3 years yeah. ago. And I wrote on Facebook, and I wrote, normally you can't, you know, shut me up. I said, but I can't even put into words freedom that I feel knowing I don't have to look over my shoulder anymore. And people say, oh, he's old. He's not coming after you. I said, you know what? Age has no difference. I said, besides, he said if he couldn't find me, he'd send somebody to find me. And then he left me in a basement because he had me sign a sexual slave contract. You know? And, yeah, so I was always in fear. And matter of fact, Victoria Kelly isn't even my name. I changed my name so I could do public speaking. Victoria, of course, means victorious. Ruth was my middle name, which means spirit. And Kelly means warrior, so it's victorious spirit warrior. And when I started speaking out in 1986, I sure didn't feel like a victorious spirit warrior, but it was almost, you know, something like, this is what I want to be, so this will be my name. But today I feel like a victorious spirit warrior.
Well, I would say after knowing you, and I know you, and for anybody who just listens to that part of your story, and I know it's just such a small fraction of, you know, the history
yeah.
and all treatment that you endured for so long, you are the epitome of hope and of the fact that one can be healed and do amazing
yeah.
things and make a huge impact, you know, in the very mission that we, you know, that I mentioned as we opened up the show. I mean, you have just really, really, transferred over to me from just this world of evil to this world of hope. You know, it's been this transference and this almost like, you know, a caterpillar and a chrysalis, it becomes a butterfly. And you just amaze me. You just absolutely amaze me. And you are so articulate.
Yeah,
and,
at the Battered Woman Shelter, at the Battered Woman Shelter, they did a Take Back the Night kind of thing, you know. And one of the T-shirts they had, it was a phoenix, and it said, from the ashes of bondage to the wings of freedom. And I tell you what, that is pretty much what it's been. But I tell you what, it's not just that quick.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot in between.
Yeah, it's a lot of, I saw a quote, you know, inky black darkness, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's
to get through.
I'm also a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, and I tell people, it's funny because they ask me to speak, and the first thing they say is, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, but alcohol and drugs weren't my problem. And I'm pretty sure everybody thinks they'll tell you even up there.
Right.
I say drugs and alcohol were my solution to my problem. You know,
exactly.
And I said, getting sober and drug free was the easy part. Living life on life terms, and with these memories, that's the hard part.
Yeah, I think there are so many people that are dads right now that are listening to you that can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm shipping.
And a lot of people say, well, you're making excuses by, you know, using your childhood or whatever. So I'm not making excuses. I'm just telling you reality. And I've also been in Al-Anon for 39 years. And my joke is it took me 3 years in Al-Anon to figure out they were talking about me. Which is not true, because I knew right away when I was 15 and started using that was it for me. You know, I watched my family drink and do drugs, and that's how they dealt with life. And I'm like, now I see it. You know, now I see it. Yeah, okay, this is it. And, it's not that you're blaming it or trying to get out of it or not, you know, taking your part in it or whatever. But, you know, they used to believe that, okay, so say you were raped or victim of childhood abuse, say it was physical, emotional, whatever, they would always say, well, what is your part in it, you know? And finally, you know, they're starting to come out in a lot of the recovery programs and types where it says right in there, if you were abused, you do not have a part in it. You do not, you know, people are making amends to their abusers for being a part of it. So some people, you know, interpret things, and then I went to NA, and people are like, because I'm on psychiatric meds. Oh, you're on drugs. You need to get off them. And I tell you what, three different times I went off my medication because I believed them, you know. And every time I ended up in the hospital, suicidal. And so now what I do when people tell me, you know, you're on drugs, you need to get off those meds or whatever, I say, you know, are you a medical doctor? And they go, no. I said, oh, you're practicing medicine without a license? I said, I go to a real doctor, and my doctor says I have to be on psychiatric meds, so I think I'll listen to them.
So it's amazing because, to me that you can relate these some of these, you know, incidents and stories with a laugh, you know, and with you know, you're kind of laughing, and that just kind of amazes me.
Yeah.
Have you found humor as a good therapeutic modality?
Well, often I say, you know, if I don't laugh, I'll cry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes, you know, the hard reality and truth and stuff makes people very, very uncomfortable. And so every once in a while I have to, you know, just throw in a joker, you think they're going to lose it, you know.
Right.
And also, you know, I speak for Al-Anon too, you know, and there's a part in there that says, you know, do this, do that, and you'll be restored to sanity. And I will say, how can you be restored to something you never had? You know, I never knew what sanity was. I had to learn all that. Well, that's why even after 32 years sober, I still go to meetings.
Can you describe in your own words what recovery is to you when you say I'm in recovery and, like, you know, recovery from your childhood, you know, recovery from the sexual abuse, the child abuse? Can you, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I know we talk a lot about recovery, and I'm interested in your definition of that and what that means to you.
Well, you know, I a lot of people say, you know, I used to say I'm a victim, and then finally, you know, it got, the term survivor came out, you know, because I'm talking years ago was when I started getting help. You know, I went to a Battered Women's Shelter in 1986, and that's where I sobered up. 85. That's when I sobered up and started volunteering in 86. And, you know, it's called my double victim. I was a victim. And, you know, finally I got the term survivor. Well, that was cool. And I did a lot of writing and speaking and this and that. And then I wrote one thing one time and I says, survival is just not enough. You know, just getting by day-to-day surviving and making it through is not enough. So I think for me, recovery is learning how to live life, like I said, on life terms, and realizing that these things happen. You know, I have these diagnoses, and like up the yin yang, and, you know, I used to say, you know, I'm a multipolar, you know, something like that, or I'm bipolar, and I finally got told, you have a diagnosis of bipolar. You know, you are much more than your mental health or your mental illness at the time is what they called it, you know. And you're a mother, you're a daughter, you know, you're an artist, you're a writer, you know, it's just so much more defined by that. Mm-hmm. And also, not only that, okay, so I have these certain diagnoses, and I can limit myself by saying, well, I have bipolar, or I have complex PTSD, and I isolate, well, I could stay isolated, or I could say my, you know, my tendency is to isolate. That's my first thought, or to run, you know, or to hide, or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, but to say, okay, that's what I do, but I don't want to. How can I change that, you know? And so taking risks and going out and being with people, you know, talking about what happened to me. And I also want to say, too, that even though you are a survivor, a lot of people think that, oh, you're a survivor and you should go talk about this to help other people. You know what? Surviving your abuse is enough. You do not have to go. There are many people that do not ever tell their story that are doing just great, you know, and they do mm-hmm. other things, you know, that benefits community. They're productive in the community, you know. You don't have to tell your story and help victims of abuse just because you're a survivor. Your surviving yeah. is enough.
Thank you so much for saying that.
Oh, it's great if you want to, but that's a choice, you know. That's a complete choice.
You know, exactly. And thank you so much for saying that and for really defining, you know what recovery is, because I think it's important to know for those that are listening that are, you know, on their journey, wherever it is, there's no measuring
yeah.
stick. You know, there's no yeah. formula where one size fits all. I love the way you described it, Victoria, and you are so many things, you know, you have so many titles, as we
yeah.
all do.
And everybody does, you know.
Exactly.
I'm a dog mom, exactly. you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm a gardener now, and I have a house I'm living in. My life is completely different than it was. You know, I was in and out of nursing homes, hospitals, assisted living, mental hospitals, this and that. You know, if I got kicked out of the last place I was at, which they tried to over my service animal, I had to get a disability law attorney and fight it. That would have been my 20th time homeless. So I went on Facebook, you know, like everybody does, and just like blah, 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 and wrote down, I'm giving away all my stuff. Well, my daughter's a director of a dual dependency program that's got a whole bunch of programs here in Minnesota. Red flag, right? Suicidal red flag. And so anyway, her and my son tried to call me about 3 days. I wouldn't answer the phone. And I finally, I give up. I'll answer it. So I did. I'm surprised they didn't send the cops out to do a welfare check, but they didn't. And anyway, so they get a hold of me and my son says, hey, Mom, I'm thinking of investing some property in Minnesota. I was wondering if you could live with Dad. Well, he and I have been divorced for years, but we're friends. You know, we both have the same amount of recovery and, you know, we got kids and this and that, you know. I said, yeah, I guess I could live with Dad. And he says, I was wondering if you guys could, you know, move into this house and take care of it for me. And so we, you know, we finally got this house here. And also I'm living in a duplex, and I got a yard for my service dog to run in. And I got stability, you know. I've never had that. I told my son I feel better physically, emotionally, spiritually than I have my whole entire life. He said, really, Mom? I said, yeah, I have stability now. I've never had that before in my whole life, ever. And it's amazing that, you know, you can do more when you know that you're going to be in that neighborhood that you're organizing in, you know, to show up the next month at the meeting or something, you know, that, oh, where that
right.
way to go.
But in everything you shared, you know, what I hear is that you decided it was your, you know, you may not have had a choice when you were a baby and you were brought home at
yeah.
birth.
Right.
You were subjected to horrific crimes. But you
mm-hmm.
you didn't choose, but you certainly chose recovery. You chose hope. You chose
yeah.
to change your life. You
yeah.
chose to seek and obtain freedom. And that was a choice that was within your control, and it's something that you were able to do
yeah.
for yourself.
And
that takes a lot of courage.
And I keep reminding myself to this day, you have choices.
Yeah.
you know, because I keep forgetting that. I keep forgetting that I'm an adult. And, you know, I have I can have choices because my mind still doesn't think I can sometimes, you know. And but I did want to bring up one thing in the introduction that I want to clear up. You mentioned that I had been promiscuous. Well, I don't like using that term, and I'll tell you why. Because women and children get called promiscuous, and men don't. You ever notice that?
And I have.
Well, I don't like that term because it's kind of a blaming thing. I ended up being very sexual with multiple partners because basically I believed my whole entire life until I started getting, you know, therapy, that the only reason God put me on this earth was to sexually satisfy men. And the reason why I believe that, I can remember being 4 years old and my grandparents taking me into bars because they raised me since I was a year old. And I can remember these guys putting me on their laps and kissing me and putting their hands up my dress and, you know, fondling me. And I remember telling my grandma, I don't like when they do that, and why are they doing that? And her response is, because they think you're cute. Yeah. So, you know, like no protection from them, obviously.
Mm-mm.
You know,
yeah.
And yeah, there, you know, there was a point right there where they could have said, hey, don't do that, you know, and told me no, what they were doing wasn't right. You know, those guys should never have been doing that and protecting me. They see what was going on and didn't do them. And that is one thing that really bothers me, that when people know what's going on and don't do anything to protect children, I've had people say, well, I'm afraid of the family, or, you know, I'm afraid of accusing them or whatever. I say, you know what, you're afraid? Think about what that little child is going through. You know, you have more power than that child does.
And then it's our moral and actually, you know, lawful obligation to do something. You know, we are not exempt from that. We are actually required by many different types of laws to intervene.
Yeah.
You know, Victoria, we've got a really full panel, and are you okay if I break to the panel? Because I'm sure.
Absolutely.
For sure. Okay. Well, I'm just going to first go to Kim, my co-host, and Kim, just invite you into the conversation with Victoria.
Hey. Hi, Ian. Hi, Victoria.
Hi.
Hi. I know. We've been Facebook friends for a little while. I don't know, though, that I've ever really heard much about your story. And there's so many, you know, things that I can just relate to. Of course, with your story, like usually we can with every story, even though our experiences are different.
Right.
But my first daughter had a sperm donor as well. I say that as well. That's what he was. And then feeling like I always just wanted sex. That was something that I just remember too. Because from what I can remember, from the time I was 5 years old, I had guys around that liked me. And I knew that they liked me. But, you know, what does that mean to like a 4 or 5 year old? Really, unless somebody is letting that 4 or 5 year old understand that, yeah, they can say that they like you, but they can't touch you. I mean, you know, so it's so frustrating. And I'm so sorry, again, just to hear that your story is so similar, you know. I'm so sorry that you had to go through all of that. It's just it's not fair and it's not right. And your grandma saying that the guys liked her. That's kind of, my mom basically told me when I was 15 that, sexual abuse just happens. When I told her that my dad had touched me, she said, it happens.
Oh, wow.
So I understand, you know, I connect with you on that too. I'm like, I'm not the only one out there that was really screwed up.
No. Well, the other thing I wanted to say, too, is that you know, a lot of people, sometimes I tell my story and they go, oh my God, mine's not as yours, or, you know, it was only my stepfather, you know, things like that. And I say, you know what, it's all youth and none of it should have happened. And we need to look at our commonalities rather than our differences, because that's how we're going to heal. We all felt fear and shame and sadness and fear, maybe not exactly the same when, you know, even similar situations, but we just have so much in common. Let's not, you know, let's not compare stories, that's for sure. Mine's worse, mine's better.
No.
You know, people do, is what I'm saying. You know, they hear my story and they go, oh my God, you know, mine's the bad, so therefore I shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't even be looking at mine or looking at my abuse, and, you know, and it's like, no.
It's trauma. It's huge.
Yeah, and you deserve to heal just like everybody else does. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my questions then is, how do you feel when you're stepping into these conferences and being, you know, put on as an expert? Is that hard for you at times?
Well, yeah, I get the jitters every time. 4, usually 2, 3 days, I'm so anxious. But, you know, I just, you know, I do a lot of self-care and self-comforting and take a lot of, you know, even though I'm preparing maybe a speech or something, you know, I take a lot of time just to do a lot of self-care, self-love, you know, and just time out. Tell my kids, no, you don't have time out. I have a time out. I don't send my kids to the room. I send my stuff to their room because they got the TV and they got the games. Don't send my kids to the room. They got all the stuff in there. She's like, go to the room. And they have to sit on the couch and do nothing.
So how old are your children? You have children living with you still? How old are they?
She'll be right back. She accidentally dropped. There she is. Okay. That's all right. That happens. So I'll just unmute her mic again. There she is.
Yeah, my phone doesn't like me. My phone and my computer and my printer, they're all against me. I said I'd throw my computer and print out the window, but I can't afford to buy a new window.
No, that's okay. No. So I'll let somebody else ask you a question and I will come back to you and chat with you in a little while. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. And so I'd like to bring on Annie. Annie, you're on with Victoria. Do you have a question or a comment for her?
Yes, thank you, Penelope. I have a comment. I have several comments on commonality. I heard so many things that were the same as my story. And I remember when I was first in healing, in recovery at all, that was what opened my eyes. When I heard my story coming out of somebody else's mouth, I realized, I was abused. You know, I couldn't really see it until I saw somebody else saying it. And I wanted to say, I too am a dog mom and a gardener. And when you said survival is not enough, I am at that place now. I spent a lot of years completely absorbed in recovery, just 100% of my time, and I needed it, and it really helped. And now it's only a fraction of my time. I do other things. I have a life different than just being about abuse. And I'm happy about that.
That's
and
that's
I wanted to make one more comment, and that is I, too, was very sexual, quote, unquote. I used to call myself promiscuous, but I know that's not true. It's not promiscuity. It's a symptom. It's a symptom of having been abused. And I remember thinking that I could control a man completely.
Right.
I remember that. It was about control for me.
Yeah, I felt that
so
way too, but
I
really, that was just an illusion. That was an illusion.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Well, you talk about the survival part, you know. It reminds me of that show Survivor, you know, like eating bugs, you know, scounging for everything. And, you know, we just all deserve so much better than that. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. Thank you, Annie. Thank you for your comments. And as always, I always learn from Annie. Every time she even offers a comment, I have an insight or I can align with that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why I think that was the beauty of being on the panel. So I actually want to introduce a new NAFSA family member who's joined us on the panel. This is Will. And Will, I'm going to unmute your line and just welcome you to the show. And see if you have a question or comment for Victoria. So, Will, you are live. And I've unmuted your mic if you'd like to offer Victoria a comment or a question.
All right, I just had a quick question. I want my notes. About how she said that not everybody needs to be an advocate to tell the story. I really, really, really like that because I never thought of myself as being an advocate either. I never wanted to do it because, for me, I wasn't there emotionally, I guess, yet to kind of tell my story. So I thought that was really cool on that aspect. And then the second part, I wholeheartedly believe that I hate the term promiscuous because as a gay male, that term is very misconstrued with us as well. And so I agree with you on that.
Definitely. Definitely. And, yeah, I just want to go back because a lot of people say, oh, well, we've healed enough, you can share your story. Well, there's still, you know, still the point is it's enough to have survived. It's enough to live a good, happy life that you deserve. That's good enough. I mean, that's beyond good enough. That's fabulous, you know. If you want to go to the next stage, you know, but that's not necessarily because you healed a certain point. It's because you chose to do it, you know?
Yes, no, I completely agree because sometimes even when I did my own speaking, I was ready, but then I was also nervous because it's like, yes, like you said, I have healed, but I wasn't quite ready to express that to everyone else to be so. I think it was for me, I wasn't ready to be so vulnerable with everybody. And then I wrote the book, and then, like, it has been so well received. So I'm like, okay, maybe this is a lot easier, but still at times I'm like, when people come up and ask me about it, I'm still, like, cringe because I'm like, I'm ready to tell my story, but also I'm not there 100%
yet. What's the name of your book?
It's called This Is Me Trying, Navigating Through a Lifetime of Trauma.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, because we like to help, you know, survivors that have written books and stuff. And also, welcome to the NAFSA family.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful to know that somebody's able to reach out, you know, and hopefully get something on a NAFSA. Because it's just, if people don't know, go on a NAFSA website. There's so much fantastic information. And I've been giving the information out to parents and say, you know, parents are really concerned about how to protect their children these days. And I said, go on NAFSA. There is a whole section on talking to your kids, the little videos you can watch with them, you know, and start this conversation. You know, because when I grew up, it was stranger danger and this creepy old man peeking out behind a bush. And I never saw that man. But
yeah.
I sure seen a lot of abusers, you know, but none of them like that man. They all look normal.
Well,
Well, you know, actually, Will and Victoria, you brought up a really, you know, really good point. And to add your comment, Will, and also Victoria, you know, at one point in time, my story was very therapeutic for me. But another point, I felt it was harmful for me. So I feel like my recovery is kind of like the clouds. You know, they come and go. And what works for me one day may not work for me the next. So, Will, what you just had shared, I was actually kind of nodding my head, and that really helped me kind of put that together for myself. You know, it's okay to say, I'm not in a place right now where it serves me in my recovery, you know, to keep retelling my story.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. When you hear something like what your comment, you know, your comment, Will, it almost gives me permission to allow myself to go there.
Yeah.
And same with you. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. You're welcome. I'm glad I could help.
Well, and I echo everybody's, you know, sentiments. Welcome to the Nazca family, and, you know, thanks for calling in. And we've got about 49 minutes left, so I think we'll be able to go down the panel again, Victoria, hopefully, and Will will bring you back on hopefully one more time during the show. So
yeah.
I'll put you in listen-only mode, and let's continue on. So, Victoria, you've given us some, you know, some background on your history, and we've had, you know, some talks about, you know, the definition of recovery and you know, self-labeling, right, and part of that is the journey. And so where do you want to go from here? Because there's so much more that we can talk about with respect to what your history and
well,
what you're kind
of looking
at. Well,
I was going to say in 1986 I started volunteering with a women's shelter, and my children were 6 months old and 4 years old, 3 years old. And anyway, I started volunteering. And so, you know, I'd go help people at the grow up women at the shelter and stuff. And then all of a sudden it's home built today too. Back then it was, you go to conferences, it was all professionals talking about people that they helped. And then they interpret it the way they believe what was going on. And so you'd be sitting there going, and that kind of sounds right, but not really. It was how they seen you, right? And so right at that period of time, 86 up a few years, is when survivors started speaking out, you know, along with the professionals. I mean, because there's a point where professionals are needed, you know, but there's also a point where survivors' stories need to be told. And so I was one of the first people that were invited to speak at some of these conferences. And what was amazing about it is they were in different areas, and they paid for my travel expense. They paid for my child care, like actual rates, so you didn't have to get, like, the dope dealer next door to watch your kids. You know, actually pay somebody a child care rate and your hotel stay and your food. And so they pay for all that if you were one of the speakers. And so I started doing that, and I was with an organization called Whisper, Women Hurt in Systems of Prostitution Engaged in Revolt, like an opinion there. And I started speaking out about being used in prostitution. But like I said, until about 12 years ago, maybe when I met Bill, I never talked to you about the child abuse part. Bill, so much shame about it. And so anyway, I started doing that, and then about 15 years ago, I started my own grassroots organization, and I started putting on events. April's Child Abuse Awareness Prevention Month, and October is Domestic Violence Awareness Prevention Month, which is coming up, of course, next month. And so many days here is August, October 1st. And so I'm putting on an event with my co-coordinator, who is Deanna Soto, who is also a Nazca family member, and she's in California. I'm in Minnesota, so this was kind of, you know, she helped me with the last one for child abuse. And what we're doing is, I don't know if many of you know about George Floyd, who was murdered here in Minneapolis by a police officer, a black man. And they have what's called George Floyd Square. And it's two blocks. Actually, let me read this a bit. George Floyd Square, officially George Perry Floyd Square, is the commemorative street named for this section of Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis from East 37th Street to East 39th Street. It's named after George Floyd, a black man who was murdered there by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin on May 25th, 2020. The streetway and memorial site is centered at the 38th and Chicago intersection. And so that's kind of the history of it. And it was, you know, the public outrage over his murder resulted in the largest mass protest movement in the United States history, largely over issues of systematic racism and political police brutality. Racial justice activists and some community members erected barricades and closed the 38th and Chicago Street intersection to vehicular traffic for over a year during the George Floyd Square occupied protest in 2020-21. Artists and demonstrators installed several exhibits, paintings, sculptures, and other works of art to memorialize Floyd and visualize racial justice themes. City of Minneapolis officially designated the streetway as George Perry Floyd Square in 2022. Long-term planning for an official permanent memorial to Floyd at the site is underway. And so that's that. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is because that's where I'm going to have my event is out there in that area. And there's a building there called The Square, and it's where communities have organized in this building, and not just around that issue, but around other issues. And somebody recommended it to me because I was going to have it in a park, and the park wasn't real thrilled about it either because they shut off the water here in Minnesota at the parks, and they would have to bring out porta potties. They weren't really going to make any money off me, so they weren't really excited. Plus, they were worried about us being out there in the weather. And anyway, so somebody recommended to go to the George Floyd Center. Or the square. And so I made arrangements, went over there. The woman gave me an excellent price. And it's a huge building. There's a big entryway area where I can have services and stuff set up, tables there. Small little area. We could probably sell buttons and bumper stickers that we have. And then on the inside is a huge room where we can have our event. We're having an event on October 29th. It will be from 1 to 5. It's going to be an in-person event out there, and then it's also going to be on Zoom. And hopefully we can get somebody to run whatever they call it, run stream or whatever you call it, live stream on Facebook. And so we're also doing what's called the Clothesline Project, which we did for child abuse, and we got a whole bunch of clothes, and I've got videotapes and everything of that, of all the clothing that adult survivors of child abuse wrote on messages of how they felt, you know, when they were little kids being abused. And anyway, mine was a little teeny 6-month-old dress that said, some children are too young to tell. And there were many others. You know, I you know, told him no, but it didn't stop, you know, or I told my mommy she didn't care, whatever the messages were. And so we had that up on the clothesline, and we did a Zoom event. There weren't a lot of people that came to the park out there that we had to that. The amazing thing is the people that did come to the park, one person walked all around, you could just see tears streaming down her eyes. And I tell you what, that began her recovery. And I always say, if no matter what I do, if I can help one person, you know, or help one person with their healing, it's all worth it. And so right there, it was worth it. And we had even a news station that showed up on the Zoom. They were there during the whole event. Now, they didn't do nothing, you know, to recognize it. But I tell you what, maybe a seed was planted. You know, we just never know the ripple effect of doing things. And I had speakers from all over the world that were survivors and advocates. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know what? That is such a profound statement. Never underestimate the power of planting even the smallest seed. And you better believe. And I remember the project because I was on that kind of on and off that day. I remember you sitting up in the park. I mean, I was so impressed that you had done that. You know, that event. Mm-hmm. You're just so confident in putting those events together, and it really is inspiring. And the fact that you made it accessible by having, you know, it accessible for someone like me who's in the state of Washington, you know, in and out of soccer games for my sons that day, to be able to still participate, you know, and be present in some way. That was really amazing. But to your point of just, I think that, you know, doesn't matter really how far along you are in your recovery. Doesn't matter, you know, the size of the gesture.
You know, we can never underestimate, you know, the potential act of something even that we would dismiss as being really small.
So
thank
you.
Well,
for me, too, you know, it's easy, just, you know, for a lot of people just to throw money at a project, you know. But for somebody to dedicate their time and energy and even the support, you know, like Bill had me come on the radio show for other people, you know, called me up and say, hey, how's the event going? You know, how you doing on it? You don't realize how much that means, you know, as far as emotional support to somebody or coming out and helping tear down or coming out and maybe hanging up the clothesline. You know what I mean? These are things that maybe don't take a lot of effort, but they are sure valued. And, you know, you just, yeah, you know, you look outside and you see these great big tall giant trees and they're producing, you know, nuts and berries and all this other stuff, you know, flowers. And you just go, that started from one little seed. And that's what I keep thinking of, you know, one little seed. And also the fate of a mustard seed. Things will get better. And, you know, that's all it takes is just a little bit of faith. Because, like, when I walked into the AA program, I had no hope. I was totally hopeless, you know. And, you know, hope is just so amazing, and belief that your life can be better, and that also you deserve a better life, you know, deserve more than survival. Like I said, survival is not enough. And so me, just because, as I don't remember her name, was talking about, when somebody else puts something into words, it helps to tell your own story. For instance, when I first got away from my biological father and escaped from him, I went to the police, and as he's asking me these questions, he's like, you know, what happened when you went over, over to his house, you know? And I said, well, he made love to me. And the cops stopped the tape, backed it up, and said, I'm going to ask you that question differently. And I said, okay. He said, when you went over to his house, did you want him to have sex with you? And they go, absolutely not. You know, but I didn't even realize the term rape, you know, was the term. Because you don't, you know. I like, yeah, guys are being nice to you, you know, or guys think you're cute, whatever. No, they're molesting you, you know. And they shouldn't be doing that. They're adults, you know. Well, they couldn't help it. You know, that child was promiscuous. I was old, 4 years old. You know, blame it on the child. No, no, no. You've got to be an adult.
Victoria, do you think that, you know, in that incident, though, you know, there were a couple things that I wanted to point out, that what you said that I've heard so many, you know, like Kim had said, you know, our experiences may be slightly different, but a lot of the time, our feelings, you know, are the same. And you had mentioned that, you know, upon being questioned by the cops, the way they rephrased the question actually brought you to a place where you could see that what you had thought was normal, right,
uh-huh.
or maybe
right.
deserved, was actually, in fact, anything but that. And I think sometimes we have shame over the fact that not shame, but maybe even that we deserve.
Well, I'll tell you why I said that, because he had made me sign a slave contract, right? Okay, so if he said I had to say it was making love, then that's what I had to say it was. If I objected to what he was doing to me, then I got punished for not going along with what he said to do. And so those words were so ingrained in me that I didn't believe in my heart of hearts that I could really say my truth, you know, and that's why I say speak your truth, you know, even if your voice shakes, is what a lot of us say now, you know, but yeah, because I was not able to tell people what really happened to me, because I was told what I should say, you know, the joke was incest is best, you know, and that was just funny to my family, to everybody else. You know, and so you get trained to react and say certain things. Not that I didn't think there was nothing wrong with it. I hated it. I had a six-month-old child, daughter, that he wanted to take me to Louisiana, marry me, and raise her as our daughter, which I knew what that meant. that he was going to start sexually abusing her. And my only option, I figured, was to dose her and drug her so she would die and do the same thing to myself. And that was my only idea of escape.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I wasn't going to leave a note either because I didn't want nobody to know because I was so ashamed. I'd rather them think I was a horrible mom and it killed my kids, you know, and myself than to tell what was actually going on. But I didn't know how to tell it.
Do you think part of your recovery included you learning how to love yourself because of what you described?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say that other people loved me before I could love myself. And, you know, I had an AA sponsor to love me before I could love myself. I was doing self-harm, cutting myself, you know, starvation, all kinds of stuff, you know. And it wasn't bulimia or anorexia or anything like that. It was just I didn't think I deserved to eat, breathe air, consume food, anything, you know. I did not believe I deserved anything because that's the way I was told all my life. By my grandparents. My grandparents had found out they weren't my parents, found out they adopted me, and not even adopted me. They just threw me in school under their name. They didn't tell me I was their grandchild. You know, I went to live with them on my first birthday. And at that time, we just registered. I was even my doctor records, even back then, I was adopted, I was 13, were in their last name. Not only that, my grandma changed the spelling of my first name. they just put me in school with a completely different name than I was given at birth. And brought me to the doctor, and that was my name on my doctor records and everything. I didn't even know my name was spelled the right way, my first name, until I got my original birth certificate.
Wow.
It was Catherine, and my biological mother had spelled it C-A-T-H-E-R-Y-N, and my grandmother changed it to Catherine, K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E. And the neighbor told me that they are my grandparents, you know, and I came home crying, and I said, you know, they said you were my grandparents. Well, apparently the neighbor adults knew and had mentioned to the kids. Or a kid overheard, and I came home crying, and tell me it's not true. And my grandma said, no, we are really your grandparents. Your mom and dad didn't want you, and your mother was going to adopt you, anybody who wanted you. We had to take you. Oh, boy, that makes you feel good. I always could tell my mother.
But here you are. You don't even know really the proper spelling of your own name. I mean, you weren't even gifted with an identity, right? The correct identity. I mean, it was very casually handled. And you were told that you weren't even wanted by your parents. Can you explain how you started that work on learning how to love yourself? What did that look like?
Well, first of all, when I escaped from my biological father, I couldn't put three words together, believe it or not. Because you can't jump yet, no. But I couldn't put three words together. Couldn't look nobody in the eye. I shook all the time. They had me on heavy doses of medication. But they put me on antidepressants. And my whole world was like a black and white TV. And all of a sudden you turn it on and it's color. That was the drastic change. My doctor says you've been depressed all your life. You just never knew it. You know, and I got on antidepressants. But they put me on a whole bunch of psychiatric meds that gave me tardive dyskinesia really bad in my mouth. I had mouth movements all the time, and I was have dentures, so I was popping out my teeth. It drove my daughter crazy. But I had to place my kids in permanent foster care because I wasn't the mom I wanted to be, and I wasn't the mom my kids deserved. You know, things like my daughter would come up to me at 10 at night. Mom, are you going to cook dinner? You know, are we going to have dinner tonight? And I'd go, oh, my God, I hadn't even cooked my kids dinner. You know, my daughter going to preschool, getting up in the morning, knowing that after a certain show, she had to, you know, get dressed and finish another show, and she had to go out and be on the bus. You know, I mean, things like that that I just knew were wrong. And I called child protection on myself and said my kids need to go in foster care and put my kids in foster care. And people at AA were going, well, you're doing so much better now. You should get your kids back. I go, my kids are just fine. They're stable. They're doing well. And I'm not going to disrupt their life because I don't know if I'm going to be back in the hospital with my mental health issues again. And they're going to be bouncing around in foster care, and that ain't right. But when I first got in the hospital, you know, it was like, you know, they would say things like, well, I think you need to set some boundaries. And I'd be like, what the hell are boundaries? You know? And so, like, you know, they just had to explain to me simple. They gave me a medallion, a little teddy bear on one side, and on the back to my own self be true. I brought that to every single meeting I went to at the hospital and said, what does this mean? And they said, you know, like, what's your favorite color? I'd be like, I don't know. You know, what do you like to eat? I don't know. You know? Well, if somebody takes you out on a date and they say, where would you like to go? I say, you know, what do you say? I'd say, well, where do you want to go? You know, I have no clue what I like. It was like just discovering who I was to begin with, you know, and, you know, my sponsor just being there. You know, I thought she'd duped me into going to an AA meeting because I met her through the Battle of Women's Shelter. And she said, I thought you guys were looking out of a bottle. And she said, Victoria, you think you can't be an alcoholic? I said, oh, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I said, but I'm one of those alcoholics can't be helped. She's like, what kind of alcoholic is that? Well, I told her I told her for 33 years before she passed away what kind of alcoholic that was. And anyway, she says, I'm going to be speaking this Saturday night. I was going to come listen to me because I need somebody in the audience, you know, be able to look at it that understands. And so I thought, oh, shit, man, I'm going to go Friday afternoon. So Saturday night without drinking, how am I going to make it? Okay, well, I got to do this for this lady, and she's my friend about it. So anyway, we get over there to the A Club, and everybody's like, hi, Kay. Like, I got freaking doped. All those people know her. Well, anyway, she told her story. I cried through the whole thing. But I found out afterwards I was not duped. The reason why she wanted me to, because she told her story many times about being an alcoholic. She had 8 years sober. What she didn't tell is about her battering experience of being battered, you know. She never incorporated that in her story when she told it. And she needed me there to look at me in the audience because she'd never been able to tell that part. And I tell you what, it's over from that day on, 36 years now. And I really think that was the beginning. I started having feelings like I never had feelings before. You know, I was totally numb. And I said, I don't like this, you know. And she just kept saying, you know, getting sober and drug-free is easy. Living life on life's terms, that's the hard part. You know, not using chemicals to, you know, try to cope with things. And it was not easy, but I called that woman all the time. She was in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down, and I'd go over to her house, and me and her would go everywhere. I'd pick her up and, you know, by the back of the pants out of the wheelchair and put her in my car, and we'd just go everywhere, shove the wheelchair into my back seat. We went everywhere, you know. And, you know, I just said somebody to call whenever I needed to. I called her up when my daughter had on her 8th birthday. And all I can remember is my 8th birthday and all the alcohol. So I called her up and I said, I just got one question. She goes, what? I go, how do you have an 8-year-old birthday party without alcohol? And she goes, what? And I said, I just remember my 8th birthday and all the alcohol. And I'm just trying to figure out how to play this party. I don't have a clue, you know. And that's what they talk about in the program. You know, we can solve problems that used to baffle us. Well, that baffled me. And there was a lot of things that baffled me.
Wow.
I used to think we were poor because, and that's what my grandparents drank, and then I realized we were poor because they drank. You know, it's just a whole different, like, spinning the filter around, you know, in your air conditioning, whatever, it's in backwards. Everything just changed all of a sudden because I was looking at a color TV instead of a black and white. You know, that's all I can describe it. And so, you know, I asked a lot of questions. And I went to a lot of groups, and I ended up in not a psych ward. I can't tell you, I was a revolving door. But I got to tell you something. My grandchild was talking about two of their friends that had went into a psych ward. And my son and I were on the phone, and my son had been in a psych ward, too. And so my son goes, well, Grandma and I know all about that. And Luther goes, yeah, but one of my friends was in 3 times. And one had a fire, and the other one was in twice for, you know, cutting. And, you know, that's a lot. And my son goes, what do you think? You think that's a lot? Grandma's got 3 flyer miles over at the psych ward. And I started laughing so hard I almost peed my pants. because I always said I was a revolving door, and I thought that was pretty funny, but I don't know. I just, you know, my kids just know, you know, they both did their essays or whatever you call it in their psychiatry class on MPD, you know, because that's what they called it, multiple personality. And they both got bad grades because the books didn't match up to what they were writing. And because they were writing, you know, what was current, because I had current information. And the textbooks were like 10 years old. So they weren't, you know, writing the report by what the book said. They're written by what I told them. And after they brought in, like, evidence, and they got A's. So, you know, it just goes to show you, too, that, you know, we need to stay updated on this stuff. Like, instead of post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, that's what Vietnam vets get. But we have complex PTSD if we've been abused as children. You know, there's a whole different set of things that happen to a person that has complex PTSD. I actually have a graph thing that I'm going to be putting out at the event. I have a power and control wheel that I got from the Battered Woman Shelter. Just different things like educating ourselves, educating others, you know. Just learning about, you know, I tell you what, they had me diagnosed as borderline personality disorder. And me and my girlfriend were both diagnosed with that. We used to call ourselves border liars because, well, I'd be in the psych ward and I would go crawl under a table and just roll, you know, go into a ball and just start shaking and whimpering. And I couldn't remember I'd done it. So, of course, they're writing down that I'm doing it to get attention. Well, when I was diagnosed finally with MPD, they'd write down she's in an altered state and she's under the table and she's hiding and we're going to go talk to her and tell her it's safe. So two different ways that you're reacted to if you have an incorrect diagnosis from the inside out. And I read that book. Most people would be going, oh, shit, now I got, you know, this diagnosis, whatever. I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that really makes sense. Oh, this answers a lot, you know. Just with the right information. And so it can really help if we learn about, you know, what mental health issues we have, but we can't let them be in the way of, you know, I can't go outside because, you know, I didn't go outside for 3 years basically because I was afraid that he was going to find me. My grandparents would come over and take my garbage out and bring me in, like, groceries and anything else I needed, diapers for my kids, whatever. I was scared to death to leave the house. And I was told that I was paranoid. I wasn't paranoid. You're not paranoid if somebody's really after you.
And thank you. You know what, Victoria, what you said was so profound.
Yeah.
Because first of all, I've heard a lot of, you know, different stories where there are so many of us that are misdiagnosed. And sometimes
yeah.
it's because, not sure if it's really that difficult to diagnose, but it may just be the clinician who doesn't have the experience or, you know, we assume that clinicians are up to date and they're not necessarily all up to date. So, you know, it is sometimes can be somewhat frustrating, but it is important to advocate, you know, for your own recovery and to make sure that you're being treated with by the right person and do receive, you know, the right diagnosis. And I think we know inherently
yeah.
when something doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you.
And also being
document.
Treated with dignity and respect. I had a friend that was going to the psychiatrist and she goes, every time I come back there, I feel like I had a conversation with my dad, you know, who is an abuser.
Oh, wow.
And I said, what do you mean? Well, you know, he yells at me and tells me that I, you know, it was my fault, this and that, and go, why are you still seeing him? Well, I'm afraid of not seeing him because he might lock me up to the psych ward, you know, if I go against them. And I'm like, you have the right to fire your psychiatrist, you know, and get somebody else. And not only that, they interview them, go in. They're just not interviewing you. You're interviewing them. What is your experience? How are you going to help me? You know? What do you believe about this or that? Do you believe in shock treatments? Because I had shock treatments. I had shock treatments, and they were voluntarily forced. Okay, so let me explain that. I had to write a thing that it was voluntary, but they basically said, if you don't have shock treatments, you're going to lose your children and never see them again. So I call them voluntarily forced. And it destroyed a lot of my short-term and my long-term memory. And people are like, well, I think I'm going to get them because they're getting rid of all those bad memories they told me. I says, no, it picks and chooses. There are so many parts of my kids' life I can't remember because of the shock treatment. There are things I do today that I can't remember I did. And it's because it screwed up my brain. Matter of fact, shock treatments cause brain damage, and brain damage is here. And people say, well, I said, all I had to be is depressed. I was depressed too much, so they gave me shock treatments. And they said, well, did it cure your depression? And I said, well, I told the doctor it did. Oh, did it? And I go, no, but I'm not going to tell the doctor it didn't because I was going to get more shock treatments.
Which is possible.
I've had many people ask me, and I said, you know what? I can't make the choice for you. I can tell you my experience, you know, but you're the one that's got to make that choice. I can't, you know, and that's the other thing is that in recovery, we all have our own paths, and one person's path is not right for the next person. When I started the Battered Women's Shelter volunteering, they said, you know, if you tell somebody you have to leave or you have to do this or that, you're acting just like the abuser. That person has to make their own choices and their own mistakes or their own successes. And anybody that says they have to do this or that, don't tell me that they've never made mistakes. You know, and I always say people have so many regrets that I've heard people say in recovery. And I said, you know what? We made the only decision, the best decision we could with the information that we had at the time. And I got a lot of bad information and a lot of outright lies, you know, and that's where I'm making my decisions from. And once we get the correct information, we can make better decisions. And once we get coping skills, we can make better decisions. If we even remember what the coping skills were that we learned, you know, sometimes. And that's why I like support groups is because sometimes we forget. And we need somebody to say, oh, you know, I think you need to breathe. You know, the simple things, you know, or you know, you've been really working hard on that issue. You know, what helps you relax? I don't know, listening to music, drawing, journaling. Maybe you want to do that for a little while. Take a break. You deserve it. We need to be reminded of those things. And NASCA has three Zoom support groups on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays at 1 o'clock, well, Central 1 o'clock to 2:30. They're an hour and a half meetings, and I facilitate the one on Tuesday afternoons. You can find that information on NASCA right on the front page.
Awesome. Yes, awesome reminder. So NASCA does offer that in addition to the shows, five nights a week. There are these Zoom recovery meetings. They are 3 days a week, and all this information can be found on the just front page of the NASCA website. So, Victoria, I'm going to invite our panel back on one more time because we're down to almost 15 minutes left. I want to give them, I know they're probably chomping at the bit to stop hearing me talk and want to ask you a question or offer comments. So can I invite you back in the conversation with Victoria?
Hello. This is Kim.
Hey, Kim.
Hey. I don't know if I have a whole lot to say. I just appreciate you taking the time to be so open and honest with your story. I know that sometimes it's your body feels it. We've talked about this before. Your body even feels it as you're talking about it. So I also connect with you in the way that I understand the giggle, and because I do the same thing when I'm really nervous, I'll just laugh and giggle. And but you're just amazing, and all the other things that you're doing, I don't know how you could be nervous about anything because you've done so many wonderful things. But we're all human, right? And we still have doubts, and I think that comes from our trauma in our life, that we still doubt ourselves, because I do it all the time. Yeah.
Well, the old messages come back, too, that you're not good enough, then, you know, you can't do it, you can't do it, you can't do it.
Right.
That's why I said the encouragement.
Right, but you have.
A lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
And you've just been so encouraging tonight, and thank you for just all that you've shared with us. And we look forward to having you on the show then, and getting to hear you in action now.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Uh-huh.
Not to put you on the spot.
Thank you.
But yeah, so yeah, take care. Have a great rest of your week, and thank you again. Just telling your story.
Thank you, Kim, our co-host this evening, and Annie, I'd like to invite you back in to either offer Victoria a comment or question about what she's shared and what the subject that we've brought up.
Sure. Hi, Victoria again. I wanted to commiserate and say I also did not go outside for years when my children were young, and I had someone living with me at the time, and he went out and did the grocery shopping and stuff like that. But I was terrified. I thought that the FBI was coming to get me, and I thought there were ghosts, and I thought I was really crazy. I was delusional about a lot of things. Yeah. And and then I went to work never having really cured that part of me.
Mm-hmm.
It seems kind of impossible now, but it's true. Mm-hmm. Also, you were saying that you can't remember your kids' childhoods, and I can't remember my kids' childhoods really either.
I
think I've lived...
But, you know, there's too many bits and pieces, because they bring up stuff, and I go, I don't remember that, and they say, I know, Mom. And so they stop bringing up stuff. They just kind of let me bring up stuff, because they know how bad it makes. Because I start crying sometimes.
Yeah. I think one reason I don't remember is that I never created memories because I was dissociated all the time.
Oh, right. That makes sense, too, yeah. I had part of that going on, too, yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're not really even there when you're dissociated.
No.
So how can you make a memory?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I understand that.
I
do want to comment on calling yourself crazy. I used to call myself crazy all the time until this one woman I really admired was my mentor. Said to me, you're not crazy. What was done to you is crazy. You just reacted normally to all the crazy situations you were put in, you know? And then I stopped calling myself crazy.
Nice. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, I used to want to be normal, too, until somebody told me, the only thing that's normal is the setting on the washing machine. So I tell people that you don't mean normal. It's just the setting on the washing machine. You know, normal. Be unique. That's better.
Yeah. Yeah, my question for everyone is, you know, who gets to define normal anyway? I don't even know what that is. So good point, Victoria.
No.
Thank you for bringing that up. The only thing that's normal is the setting on the washing machine.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's being balanced. Maybe there's trying to find balance. But I don't know if anybody can ever truly define, you know, with laser focus, you know, what normal actually is. It's like
and
a math equation.
Is really within yourself. It's searching within yourself to what feels balanced to you. And I tell you, one time during the day, I might feel balanced doing this or that. And 5 minutes later, I have to find something else that makes me feel balanced or make me feel, you know, like I'm connected to my inner spirit. And listening to that inner voice that got squelched many years ago. I don't even know. I never even know I had one. You know, and then the weirdest question that the guy's ever asked me is, do you see things other people see, don't see? And I said, I don't know if you see these things or not. How do you know? How can you ask that question? I think it's a strange question.
Definitely. And I do appreciate, you know, even bringing up, you know, the topic of normal, because I think that once we learn that there is no normal to be achieved, and that we are not to blame, that our actions or behaviors were symptoms of what happened to us. And accepting that, that is also part of the path to self-love and self-acceptance. That it wasn't our fault.
Accepting yourself right where you're at, you know, and people go, you got 36 years sober. That's a lot. So when I got 36 years, I ended up Googling, how many seconds is it to 36 years? And so when I went up to get, we get medallions and pins, I went up there and says, no, I don't have 36 years. I have blankety, blankety, blank seconds. I say, because I can't do even 24 hours a day, one day at a time. I have to do one moment at a time, you know, because all I've got, all any of us got is this moment right here. And before we have this moment, we made choices to get to this moment, you know, and we get to take, make different choices if we want or the same choices every moment to follow. And I do, I'm doing better today than I did yesterday. And I might have some days that are really bad and I feel like a backslid, but I didn't, because I still have that knowledge of what I learned. And like I said, I might forget some skills one day, you know, or I might end up in the middle all day. But you know what? Maybe I need to just rest. Maybe I've just done too much. You know, instead of going, I'm back there to the depression where I was in bed for 3 weeks. No, I'm not. I'm just having a bad day. You know, everybody has bad days. You know, even quote normal people.
You're the one you said. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Annie. You know, thank you for your comments, and I appreciate it. So, Victoria, we've got 8 minutes left, and I definitely want to make sure that you've been able to talk about everything that you'd like to share, and also forecast in terms of your event coming up in October in recognition of Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So I'd like to hand it, you know, the floor back over to you.
Yeah, I want to say, too, it's Awareness and Prevention Month. And I always say, well, can we really do prevention, especially, I guess, when we're talking about child abuse? And the answer is, yes, we can. And I was talking to Bill, and he said the fact that you're putting on this event is a way of prevention, you know, by making people aware of these issues. And I guess I really never thought of it that way. But what I'm going to do is not only have people talk about domestic violence and the effects on children, but then also positive parenting, nurturing, loving, you know, caring. Like we call kids, you know, some people call kids spoiled brats. Usually the ones they're calling spoiled brats are kids that are nurtured, loved, considered what their needs are, you know, supported. And we got to change that word, you know, to a positive. They're not spoiled. They're nurtured, loved, cared for, you know. And I think a lot of terminology needs to change. You know, I went to the sexual assault center and they said, you know, even though it's not legally putable, rape is unwanted sex. And I don't know, that hit me like a brick wall. I went, God, did I ever want that? You know, I just can't remember ever thinking that that was a good idea, ever. You know, just that's who, you know, what I am. But anyway, I did want to say that we're doing that clothesline project. So we're asking people for T-shirts. I've got a P.O. box. People can contact me on Facebook. And if you go and ask a link, my name's on there for the show tonight. You can click on that and contact me on Facebook. But I have a P.O. box. And what we're asking for is T-shirts that have sayings on them about how children, whether you were a child that was observed domestic abuse at any point, what your feelings were, or just everybody sees it in the news and in shows and different things, just some messages to the community about how domestic violence affects children, you know, because a lot of us know some of the answers. But the big thing is, you know, that a lot of people just aren't talking about is, you know, a kid sees domestic violence and one of the partners, you know, in the domestic violence is being abused. And maybe they know where the shotgun is, you know, and well, they think they're doing the right thing by shooting the one that's the abuser. And that kid, it ruins their entire life. They're in juvenile. A lot of them are in jail for the rest of their lives. And these are kids. These are little kids that are making these decisions where they feel guilty because they didn't protect one that's being abused, you know. And I want to be really clear
that abuse happens in every kind of relationship of domestic violence, of a domestic relationship. I don't care what kind of a, you know, situation it is. If it's a partner relationship of any sort, it is not, you know, one relationship over another is more abusive. It's across the lines. It's across race, age, sexual preference, everything else. You know, it's not a certain person. Like, you know, my dad made a lot of money, very intelligent, good dresser, well-known in church, everything else. And he was a horrible, horrible person. But he had this great betrayal. Nobody would have thought he was the guy next door, just like when they go on the news and go, can you believe your neighbor was a killer? And they're like, no, he didn't act like a killer. You know what I mean? It's like, there's no creepy man that's coming out of the bushes that is the child abuser, you know? It's like we just have to change our belief by looking at the facts. And the facts are not, there's this creepy person coming outside the bushes. This is the most unsafest place to be a child, is in your own family. And then the people in the community and relations, close relations, that's the next one, you know? And the third one is strangers, and it's a very small amount, very, very small. But that's not what I was taught, and that's not what a lot of people believe. And it horrifies them, the fact that the children are being abused. And I want to say, too, that when I work with a battered women's shelter, it's bad enough that I go in there and get blamed and feel shame that they stayed in a domestic abuse situation. And you bring in the component of when children see domestic violence, it is child abuse. And then, of course, I'm not saying women because there's men and women, but they don't have shelters for, you know, men, transgender, you know, all this stuff. So anyway, whoever's being abused is already feeling the blame and shame. And you add on it that a child that witnesses domestic violence is also being abused. That's child abuse. Okay. They get more guilt and shame, the victim. And we need to really say, we got to stop putting the shame and blame on the victim. We need to put it on the perpetrator, and they need to be held accountable. You know, because there are people that go in and are in domestic abuse situations and get away and tell their story, and all of a sudden they lose custody of their children because they stayed in that relationship too long when they had no options. You know, they escaped when they could. And you know, it's just we have to get out there and have these conversations with people and make changes, because things are not right. Things are not right. I just sometimes I'm baffled by the way the laws are, the way people respond. Things need to change. And I feel like, you know, that's my mission is to make statements like that and question people. Why do you believe that? You know, where are your facts? Why would you believe that? And a lot of times it's because a lot of victims blame other victims because they were victimized and they're still blaming themselves. And when you get down to the bottom of it, I have people that come up and hey, why do you keep talking about abuse? You got 36 years sober. You think you'd be over it by now. I saw Penny and I quit talking about it, and they lean in because I can't wait to hear. And I said, as soon as nobody comes up to me after a meeting during the week or comes up to me in the next meeting and says, I was abused or I'm being abused, and nobody's talking about it. Or if there's no more child abuse in the world, they don't quit talking about it. And they are looking so disappointed. They really thought I had a date, I guess.
Well, it's clear that there is more work to do, and you are a huge force in gathering all the resources to get it done in October. So, unfortunately, we've only got 30 seconds left, but I wanted to thank you so much, Victoria, for being on tonight, everything that you shared. And for those of you listening, again, this will be archived. You'll be able to listen to the archive of this 90-minute show with Victoria Kelly as our guest. Go onto the NASCA website, look for more information on Victoria's event coming up in October. I know it's going to be there. So with that being said, unfortunately, we are at the very end. I want to thank not only Victoria for being on tonight, Victoria Kelly, our NASCA sister, and also NASCA talk show host coming this Thursday, but also Kim Lakin, my co-host, and Annie Margis, another NASCA talk show host and a panelist this evening. So as I always say, when I end the show, there are enough adult eyes and ears in this world to keep every one of our children safe. If you see something, you hear something, say something, do something. It's our moral responsibility to get involved. Thank you and good night.
Good night.